That's the end of the first half. As the teams head to the locker room, the Spartans lead the Bulldogs by a score.
You guys stink.
Jeez, Coach, we're only down a couple of points.
No, I mean you guys really smell. You need to hit the showers. And here, I got every one of you new bars of soap from the Sterling Soap Company. Each bar is artisan crafted using natural ingredients and essential oils. They also have shave soaps, colognes, beard balm, and a whole lot more. Now get in there.
But Coach, we have another half to play.
I don't care. I can't stand to be around you.
A few minutes later.
All right, bring it in tight. You guys are still playing terrible, but you're smelling great out there. Now listen, you're going to need to stock up for the rest of the season. We got a lot of tough games left. So go to sterlingsoap.com after the game. That's S-T-I-R-L-I-N-G soap.com. You got that?
Yes, Coach.
Great. sterlingsoap.com on three. One, two, three.
sterlingsoap.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hello, old sports, and welcome to another episode of the Hello, Old Sports podcast here on the Sports History Network. I'm Dan Newman. I am joined, as always, by my brother and co-host, Andrew Newman. Baseball season is upon us, and we have a baseball-related episode with a baseball author to speak with us here tonight. Another great author interview. You all have been spared recently from hearing too many episodes of just Andrew and I going back and forth with each other. So eternally grateful for that. Andrew, how are you doing tonight?
I'm well, Dan. And when you say we have another baseball episode tonight, let's just specify that that's two-word baseball. No, we did the episode a couple years ago on the 1869 Red Stockings, and we kind of thought that would be the furthest back we would go. And not to repeat myself, but I can't imagine we're going to go any further back than this at some point. But I guess never say never, right?
Yeah, no, this might be it. And just as, and we've done a number of 19th century baseball episodes. We did King Kelly. We did the 1890s Orioles. We did Spalding and Wright about a year ago. We did the 1869 Red Stockings, and we did the this episode here tonight. For the third year in a row, or maybe third year out of four, I am interviewing an author who I have previously listened to, met, seen at the annual Sabre 19th Century Conference in Cooperstown. And so we're glad to be doing this again. And, you know, a few months ago, we were interviewing an author about LeBron's Lakers, and now we're on to 1860s baseball. So we really cover the gamut here on Hello World Sports. Our guest this evening is Thomas Gilbert, who is the author of any number of baseball books. His most recent book, or now his second most recent, is How Baseball Happened, Outrageous Lies Exposed, The True Story Revealed. It was the winner of the Casey Award for Best Baseball Book of the Year. His current book, his newest book, just came out recently, Death in the Strike Zone, The Mystery of America's First Baseball Hero. It is the story of Jim Creighton. And Tom, thanks so much for joining us here tonight.
Thanks for having me.
So you even mentioned this in the book, but a lot of people, don't know who Jim Creighton is. I remember him. You know, he is the punchline to a famous Simpsons joke when Mr. Burns is putting together his first all-star team with Three Finger Brown and Honus Wagner. And Smithers says your left fielder has been dead for whatever it is, 130 years or whatever it had been at that point. Who was Jim Creighton? Give us a little bit of an idea of why this was the story you wanted to tell.
Well, for me, when I write, you know, a book about history, it starts with my curiosity about it, but it's questions that I can't find easy answers to that really get me going. And this book, you can tell from the title, is sort of semi-seriously structured as a cold case. Because we're not going to learn much more about someone who died in 1862 at the age of 21. We know everything about, we know how many times he pitched and what the score was. And we have eyewitness accounts of what he was doing. And we know how much impact he had on the game, which was almost hard to overstate. And that makes it even weirder that no one remembers who he is. Mm-hmm. I compare it, just to give people an idea of the order of magnitude, to Babe Ruth. So Babe Ruth is not only famous among baseball fans, everyone's heard of Babe Ruth, and he's been retired for almost a century because he changed baseball so much and was such a big star. Creighton changed baseball more than that. I can defend this statement a lot more than that. And people don't know about it. And he was famous. He was incredibly famous. He was the first really national baseball star when baseball was growing and it was spreading across the country in the 1850s and 60s. He was the guy that drew crowds. He was the one that was really instrumental in making fans for baseball and selling the game to the whole country. And, you know, this explains things like why he was the first baseball card. And yet, historians have been stumped by questions like, what was he doing on the mound? Like, we know the results. We know what it looked like. We don't know how he did it. Was he cheating? There was rumors and grumbling and complaints that he was cheating. I deal with this in the book. Was he illegally paid by the Excelsiors when baseball was supposed to be amateur? That's a complicated question. Why is he forgotten? You could actually, you know, do a show about that. That's an interesting phenomenon. How did he die? Was it somebody's fault? I mean, these are the questions that got me going, mm-hmm. because it's just hard to imagine someone with this much historical importance, A, being forgotten, and B, all these basic facts not being known about him. And it's a hell of an interesting story. If I'd made it up, I wouldn't have written the book because I wouldn't believe it. I wouldn't find it plausible.
Touches on so many aspects of, you know, you get into really the mechanics of what pitching was at the time, and then the larger discussion of sort of what baseball was at the time, both on the field and what people were trying to get out of it, which was basically just like, in a lot of ways, a recreational activity. One of the more fascinating parts, and we'll get back to, is you just mentioning like the idea of fans sort of becoming maybe a couple of curiosity seekers to like people watching and caring who won the game. And then, you know, obviously just the cross section of how this game spread from city to city and everything. Like, it's rare to reach this far back in the creation and sort of the formative years of a sport, which is probably a full generation or two before what people consider the formative years of the sport.
Right. And we've all been, baseball history has been shaped a little bit by forgetting, but of course, a lot of the past is remembered. It's been shaped by the fact that we look at it through the lens of Major League Baseball. And I would say the number one most important thing that fans don't know about early baseball is that professional baseball made baseball into a business, but baseball was already a national sport that was very well organized. If you're talking about how games evolve into sports, mm-hmm. baseball was 95% of the way there before the National League was founded. And Major League Baseball's just never been entirely interested in what happened before it.
I think what's sort of, in some ways, I think the length of baseball sort of kind of, you know, I mean, we think of baseball as being sort of the same sport unbroken for the last 150 or so years. Even those of us who know the sport well, I mean, you know, it's still the same basic sport. Whereas if you look at, I mean, basketball wasn't even invented when the National League started. If you look at a football game from the 1920s, say the first year of the NFL, it is a very, very different sport, almost unrecognizable. And meanwhile, if you look at Major League Baseball in the 1880s, you know, late 1870s, you know, the Braves were a team, the Cubs were a team, you know, the Giants and some of these other National League teams came along not long after. Some of the records are still, you know, active. You know, guys are still in second or third, you know, that did things in the 1880s. And so I think that people don't maybe think to look before that. We think it's okay, 1876. I mean, Sabre, which you and I are both members of, is doing the 150th anniversary of Major League Baseball this year. And if you just read real quick, you'd think it was the 150th anniversary of baseball, not just Major League Baseball.
Exactly. And, you know, the fact that people have forgotten or don't know where something came from, it doesn't change history. Right. So, Creighton, I explain in the book and I argue, is the, he's the reason for the strike zone. I mean, just marinating that for a second. Mm-hmm. So one guy, Babe Ruth, changed the way batters approach the ball. He convinced everyone that if you uppercutted the ball and hit long fly balls, you could produce a lot of runs. That's a big change. But is there anything bigger than baseball didn't used to have a strike zone? The pitchers, until, you know, through the Civil War, would toss the ball probably 40, 50 miles an hour at the plate. And the idea was the batter was on his honor to swing at a hittable pitch, and the pitcher was supposed to be putting the ball over the plate. And he wasn't a big weapon. He wasn't the reason why games were won or lost. And baseball worked that way, even though it sounds a little crazy. Creighton suddenly is throwing twice as hard as anyone had ever thrown. He has a totally different pitching delivery. He trained differently. He lifted weights, which was almost unheard of. He was trained by his catcher, who was a knowledgeable person about weight training and weightlifting. He wasn't a really big guy, but he's throwing the ball. I actually do some calculations. Just imagine if major leaguers are throwing, 96 mile an hour fastballs. Imagine if some guy just shows up in spring training throwing 160 or 180. That's not even an exaggeration. Because Creighton was throwing the equivalent of at least 100 when you figure the 45-foot distance from the pitcher to the batter. So it's the fact that the hitters were overmatched, completely overmatched, and he threw strikes. When you read descriptions by sophisticated observers about what Creighton was doing, long after he was dead, people would say about any hard thrower, he's another Creighton. And people like Henry Chadwick, who were around then, would go, no. It's not about speed. It's about speed, movement, and control. That's pretty much the definition of modern pitching.
Can you, just to set the stage for anyone who may not be, and how dare they, but anybody who may not be familiar with the rules of pitching in the 1850s before Creighton, what was exactly sort of the way they had to throw it, what they were and weren't allowed to do? Like the environment that he stepped into for what we considered pitching at the time.
Right. So you ever wonder why we call it pitching?
I did before this.
Because one of the earliest known rules says the ball must be pitched and not thrown. And what does that mean? Pitching like horseshoes. So what the pitching rules were until Creighton was, the rules didn't change, but the way people pitched until Creighton was they ran up to a line. It was 45 feet from the batter and they had to release the ball when they got to the line. So that's a little bit like cricket bowling. They run up to a spot and throw the ball, and they used to throw under him. So baseball pitchers would run up and flip the ball, but the rule said you had to keep your arm in dead straight, like a hand of a clock, and completely underhand. So you couldn't move the arm away from your body. You couldn't cock your wrist. You couldn't straighten your elbow. And the whole idea was basically to limit speed. So because it was a hitter's game, and add to that the fact that nobody has gloves. It's like Chicago 16-inch softball where there's no gloves. And what you have is you have crazy high-scoring games. There was a game in the 1860s that was won 7-4 by two good clubs, and it was met with drop-dead, slack-jawed shock all over the country. Smallest score on record. Creighton's team, the Excelsiors, they made these road trips around the country, popularizing baseball in Creighton. When they went to Baltimore, Baltimore brings out its best baseball team, and the Excelsiors beat them 51-9. And the descriptions of it are very funny. You'd think that they ran the score up. And all the Baltimore writers said, I'm pretty sure they eased off.
Why were things so centered in Brooklyn? A New York area generally, but specifically in Brooklyn, you have a chapter about the three big teams, the Atlantics, the Excelsiors, and the God, this is terrible. I'm blanking on the third one. Eckfords. That's right. Yeah. Why Brooklyn?
It's a kind of combination of lucky combination of factors. So, you know, when people ask me, there were other bat and ball games that no one's ever heard of, and we don't want to talk about anything else that no one remembers, but there was a game in Boston, there was a game in Philadelphia that was different. Different kind of baseball game. And when people are often asking me the question, well, why did New York win out over all those other games? They all went extinct. It also won out over cricket. But I think the reason is that the rivalry between Brooklyn and New York City, which were independent cities for most of the 19th century and before that, it was the rivalry between those two cities that had nothing to do with sports. It started feeding into sports rivalry. It created the first inner-city rivalry. And, you know, we take these things for granted. It's the most banal thing in sports that Boston hates New York and LA hates San Francisco. This is the first time it happened because nobody identified with sports clubs. And so suddenly you can see this process happening. And I've got a very thick file where I'm reading every game story and I'm noting what does the guy say about the crowd? How many people? And then what you see is when Brooklyn clubs in the late 1850s are starting to play New York clubs, you start seeing interest. You start seeing hundreds of people and then thousands of people. And I think it drew energy from this inner-city rivalry. Plus, Brooklyn's booming. Now, I mean, you know, New York is the richest, biggest city in the country. But Brooklyn is catching up fast. And it's attracting young people from all around the world, in fact. There are people moving from all over New England to New York. There are people coming from Europe. And it's exploding. And there's space. And there's youth. And there's enthusiasm. And you can see fans happening for the first time. There's no such thing as being a fan of a team before that.
Yeah, and I liked how you talked in the book, and you didn't use this analogy, but it was kind of what came to mind for me about how the idea of fandom was something that was not only unexpected, that it was sort of, it was strange. It would be like somebody showing up to watch me and my friends play poker that didn't know any of us, or, you know, somebody coming to your house and watching you eat dinner. It wasn't something that was considered something that people would do that the non-participants would want to come and show up and watch.
You're 100% right. And the funny thing is that some of the journalists couldn't imagine why this was happening. The only thing they could think of was that people must be gambling on it. But of course, some of them are women and children, but they're all going, what is going on? This country is totally going overboard on gambling. Why would you watch strangers play a baseball game? It's a pretty funny question.
Yeah, and it is. And I think it's one that we all probably try and avoid thinking about too much, given how much of the time we spent, you know, talking about it, reading about it, watching it, whatever. But yeah, I mean, it is. If you stop and think about it, you know, not to get too philosophical here, but, you know, there's sort of an intrinsic value in a song, and somebody can be a fan of a band or an artist, or, you know, a movie, an actor or a director or a fiction writer. But you kind of have to not question what you're doing quite so much when you're a sports fan, because there is an illogical aspect to it.
Yeah. I mean, you can watch sports just for the entertainment of watching the skilled athletes compete, which I kind of like to think that I do. But, you know, when I was 12, I lived and died with my team every single day. And that, why did I do that? I don't even know. It was in the culture.
Yeah, and still is and probably always will be to some way, shape, or form.
I was a Cardinal fan when I was a kid because the Yankees traded my favorite player to the Cardinals. And I thought Dal Maxville was a god, like a guy funny with no power.
What was it, Maris you're talking about that they traded?
Yep.
It was?
Yeah.
Thought so.
It really annoyed me. So I rooted for the Cardinals for a while. And it was an added benefit that Bob Gibson came along and Lou Brock, and they ended up having a good team while the Yankees were going downhill. But I actually was mad that they traded Roger Maris. I wrote a letter to Roger Maris when I was like 9.
not to go on too much of a digression here, but my wife's cousin never forgave the Red Sox for trading Fred Lynn. So he became a Mets fan growing up in Boston, and years later, this is like 5 years later, they had a dog, and the dog's name was Mookie, And I remember somebody said, oh, you named it after Betts. And he said, no, it's named after Mookie Wilson. I said, you got to be the only person in six New England states who's got a dog named after Mookie Wilson.
Oh, yeah, the controversial choice for sure.
Go ahead, Ange. I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say, so with sort of that, you know, stage set, Jim Creighton himself, and I know not a ton is known about him, you know, compared. There's probably a lot more known about him than most people who lived in that time frame and died before they were 22 years old. But, you know, what can you tell us just by way of sort of a brief biography about him, about how he came to baseball, came to Brooklyn?
Well, yeah, one of the first that I didn't mention is that we, poor kid who lives in the slums of the country, who turns out to be a great athlete and gets rich because some team in the big city recruits him. There's a first. Creighton was the first like that. He grew up in the Five Points section, which if you've seen the movie Gangs of New York, that's where that takes place. He grew up in this hellhole, a violent, crime-ridden neighborhood. And, you know, his father was an Irish immigrant. Jim's athletic ability got the family out of there. They all relocated to Brooklyn, and they were given a nice house, which is still standing in what's now Brooklyn Heights. And so, you know, we don't know anything about what kind of person he was, because all people knew about him was that he was the greatest athlete they'd ever seen. Now, how great? There's a couple different ways of measuring it. You die at 21. There's a lot of things we don't know about you, but here's what we do know. There was a guy, you talked about the 69 Red Stockings. You remember the pitcher?
Mm-hmm. Ace of Brainerd.
Ace of Brainerd, yeah.
He didn't get in any games with the Excelsiors, not hardly ever. So Creighton was so good that Brainerd isn't even used regularly in relief. That's one measure. I mean, there was no contest. So the guy who became the greatest pitcher in baseball for a period of years in the country is kept on the bench by this 20-year-old. Creighton, there were some money issues when the Civil War started because his team stopped playing. In 1860, they actually paid him and his father with no-show jobs, no-show federal jobs, believe it or not. The people behind the Excelsiors had a lot of influence. He was making $1,000 a year. And these things are always hard to calculate, but I put that, by looking at it from different ways, at about $500,000 a year. And that doesn't sound like that's about an hour of Juan Soto, but remember what year it was the first time a major leaguer made $500,000?
You might have had this in the book, and I don't remember, but it, I mean,
it was Mike Schmidt in 77.
I was going to say, I knew it was in the 80s time frame, yeah.
So it's, you know, that's, he was making a lot of money. Yeah. But when the team stopped playing because of the Civil War, he needed money. He was supporting a family. And he didn't have a wife or children. He had an unmarried sister. He had a brother who was sort of a deadbeat, and he had a father who was old and ill. So he starts bowling in cricket. And cricket was fairly popular in the United States because we had a huge number of English immigrants here. And they all formed cricket clubs, and cricket was pretty competitive. And there were people that wanted America to take up cricket. The journalists were pumping this for decades. And we just weren't ever, we never really were competitive at it. And in 1859, an all-star team came from England and just wiped the floor with the best American teams. And that was discouraging. Well, Creighton became so good. He picked it up in 1860 cold. He became such a great bowler that he impressed visiting English teams and one of the clubs in New York that excluded American players immediately brought him in and made him their bowler. So he's kind of a Jim Thorpe, kind of a Michael Jordan, kind of a Bo Jackson that we know about him.
And when does he start playing? I know he starts with basically a minor league team for the Excelsiors, and that's the Niagaras, right?
Right. So they bring him over. They put him on. The Excelsiors were the first team that we know of that thought of having youth teams kind of formally attached to it so that they could get talent. Nobody wanted to talk about this stuff because in the amateur era, that was a little iffy ethically. But we see that two players a year age out of the Stars, which was their top youth team, and go to the Excelsiors. And two players come from the Niagaras to the Stars to take their place, and it's all very orderly. So the Creighton is playing for the Niagaras, but he's playing mostly second base, a little bit of third. In the Simpsons, he's an outfielder, but he played very little in the outfield. Not to mention that he was too dead to play the outfield. He was a really good hitter, too, and a good fielder. There was a game where they were short a man, and he played the left side of the infield, and they won the game. It's kind of hard to imagine. Mm-hmm. So then he goes up to the Stars, and he starts pitching in his last season with the Stars in the middle of the season in July of 59. When he starts pitching for them, the Stars are under 18. This is a youth club. They're immediately competitive with the best adult teams in the country. Like, they almost beat the Atlantics, who are like the dynasty. They came very close to beating them. And then they went 8-1 against adult clubs. And try to imagine a modern equivalent to that. Like, is there a player like Shohei Ohtani or anybody, you could put them on like a D1 team or a double A team, or I mean, really a high school team, and then he would beat the Yankees?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, he was crazy good. And then he moves from the Stars to the Excelsiors. There's a game I talk about in the book where everybody in baseball knows that Creighton, and probably Creighton and Leggett, are coming up with some new way of pitching. But reporters didn't do a lot of reporting in those days, and there's nothing in the paper about it. And then he shows up and he pitches a couple innings in relief. This is his debut in July of 59. And all the game stories say, it kind of drives you crazy how lazy reporters were then. They say, wow, there's a lot of important people here, like baseball people. I wonder why. You could ask someone, but he didn't. And then Creighton comes out and he's doing this new thing he did. He's pitching with one stride, like a modern pitcher. I spent a lot of time trying to figure out what his pitching motion looked like, and I think I did. And he's also throwing the ball ungodly hard, and he's throwing curveballs. And he's throwing them right over the plate, because in those days, you could be a hard thrower and wild, and usually they were too wild to use. So they used guys who pitched slow with control. And the more than one game story that we have says that the game stopped, and there was this conference between the umpire and all the important baseball people that were there trying to figure out what to do about this. And you probably, someone was saying, is that legal? I mean, we can't hit that. And the game goes on and they couldn't hit that. And they never could hit it.
The amateurism of the era is very interesting to me, because there were a lot of strange lines. So it wasn't considered unethical. It was considered unethical to recruit. So they had to sort of fib about the fact that Creighton was a Manhattanite, not from Brooklyn. Cash payments were considered, you know, unsporting, but some of these other ways of compensating were okay. It was a very sort of strange set of ethics that went around paying players or compensating players.
Yeah, it's a hard thing to unpack, although one time I stopped and I said to myself, is it really that simple now?
Yeah.
Right. I mean, each sport has their own rules and boundaries, and they also move, right?
And look at college sports these days.
Exactly. So it's not always that simple, but there's definitely paying cash was considered wrong. And sometimes you have to look at like what people say, what complaints people made, or actually official charges were brought, to sort of sort it out. Because there was a team in Philadelphia called the Athletics. And their president resigned and officially complained that other people in his organization were paying players, and which he thought was wrong. And this guy had brought over a player from Brooklyn who lived about three blocks from where I'm sitting, had brought a guy over and given him a house and set his brother up in business. And he obviously didn't think that was wrong. So it sounds like hypocrisy, but I don't think it really was. And we know there were discussions about changing the rules. So the rule said you cannot compensate players in any way. Obviously, they compensated them in some ways. But, you know, like genealogy, the lies people tell are incredibly informative. And the one you mentioned, the team put out this bio that said that Creighton came to Brooklyn as a young boy and lived in the neighborhood with all the other Excelsiors. He came when he was 17. So it's baloney. And why would you tell that lie? Yeah, you don't want to own the fact that you brought him from another city. that just was unheard of, much less another club.
And it feels like sometimes with this and with other things like that, it's like, even if everybody knows you're lying, as long as you're going through the effort of coming up with a cover story, nobody challenges you on it.
To look at what was said in public that nobody responded to. In 1858, this is kind of funny, there was a baseball banquet. They used to have these banquets, and all the amateur clubs officers would be there. And a guy wrote a humorous song, and there's a stanza for every one of the major clubs. And he describes somebody the Excelsiors have who doesn't play for the team yet, but they control him. And they call him the infantile phenomenon. And it's Creighton, who's now two levels below the Excelsiors. He's playing for the Niagaras. Everybody in that room knows what a great athlete this is. They know that the Excelsiors found him and recruited him. And you know where the phrase infantile phenomenon comes from? It's from Dickens.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And it was a prodigy who was like a 9-year-old girl who was a great actress. And that's where our term phenom comes from. So not only is Creighton the first recruited youth athlete in any team sport, baseball or otherwise, he's literally the first person to be called that.
And that's a name that is a term that's still around today, still is largely applied to pitchers in the modern era, you know, and I'm sure almost no one would know where the origination of it is from, whether it's Dickens or Creighton. But, you know, some of these things just stick.
Yeah. If you're a historian and you are over the top, a little bit of a perfectionist like me, you know how much research I did before I said that he was the first person called that?
Probably a lot.
Because you have to look really hard for anyone else being called that.
Yeah, you got to prove the negative, which is
really hard.
Very difficult to do.
Yeah.
So his baseball career is really only 3 years. And in a lot of ways, it's really only two, right? He comes up in 60. And from what I could tell from the book, plays very little, if at all, in 1861 for reasons that might be obvious to people.
Yeah, 61, and almost none.
And that's basically because of the he doesn't serve in the war, but sort of life kind of is altered throughout the country because of the Civil War.
And the Excelsiors are sort of socially elevated, and they think it's a bad look to play baseball when there's a war going on. But they also thought it would be over quick.
Mm-hmm.
I think they thought initially they were postponing the season, the opening of the season. You know, there was general optimism that, you know, the North would win in 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
People had 3-month enlistments. And then, so Creighton doesn't play in 61. He doesn't get paid. In the 62, the sport is sort of gradually waking up and other teams are a little more active, but the Excelsiors play a few games. You got to remember that all these clubs are independent entities. They're not in a league. They're not playing in a schedule. You would issue a challenge to another club. And if you challenge the champions, you would challenge them to a 3-game series. And if you beat them, you were the champions. It was like boxing.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way it worked. But there's lots of, the Excelsiors played 3 days a week among themselves. So we don't actually know how much work Creighton did, but it was probably a lot.
Okay.
Then there's these long road trips. I did a little math because he pitched 161 innings in actual match games against other clubs. And Joe Leggett, his catcher, ends up being crippled for life. He's the human backstop. I mean, he's breaking fingers, breaking his face, ruining his shoulder. And 161 innings doesn't sound crazy, but then, all right, he's also bowling in cricket. And what's an inning in 1860? Now it's 15 pitches. And then it was 45. So very conservatively, without counting any of the practicing or the intramural games, he's throwing 500 innings by modern measure.
And he's throwing harder than anybody ever has before.
Right.
So
he's the only max effort pitcher.
So, you know, how often do you see a pitcher come up even now who's throwing harder than anybody, you know, harder than almost anybody else is. And then a year later, he's having Tommy John surgery or he's just never the same. So you're right. It's not, the number can be very misleading there. He's doing a lot to a still very young body.
You're leading right into the really unpleasant first, which is pitching destroys bodies and it ruins pitchers and it ruins their health. That's we accept it. It doesn't usually kill anybody. Mm-hmm. But Creighton died from overwork, and it's a long, sad story that I tell in the book. Uncharted territory, and I don't think you can entirely blame the team, but you can blame them a little bit, and they definitely felt guilty.
Yeah, I feel like before we get into that, if you had told, you know, if you just said to somebody, you know, he was this baseball phenom in the 1850s and early 1860s, he died in 1862 at 21 years old. Most people would say he was killed in the Civil War.
Right.
Some sort of personal, you know, whether it was drinking or, you know, whatever, or just the diseases that carried people away so frequently at the time. Sports-induced injury would not be right at the top of the list for...
No, it's true. It's very modern-sounding because he was very modern. Mm. And, you know, he had a hernia, inguinal hernia, which is very common. Today, it's not a big medical challenge. If you start having problems with it, like it widens and you're starting to get, like, tissue from your inside your abdomen bulging through it and that kind of thing. Or pain, they just put in a little mesh. It's a very simple surgery. If you somehow neglect it, and you can get an infection from it, but nobody ever reaches that stage anymore, but we would have antibiotics. And they didn't have the surgery or the antibiotics, which is the problem with Creighton. And I went to read medical textbooks and satisfied myself that everybody understood this condition. So he also had a lot of doctors on his team, including the president of the team. You know, I think they knew they were risking his health. I don't think they knew they were risking his life, but it's hard to say. They kind of accused Cricket of killing him after he died, which probably shows some consciousness of guilt because they knew that wasn't true.
Yeah, and sort of in the everything old is new again, you know, you see shades of what's gone on in the NFL over these last 20 years as the concussion thing has really come to light. You know, Andrew and I have touched in the past on pro wrestling and sort of some of the, you know, what happens to these men's bodies, and then not just the pushing it to the physical limit, but also looking for alternate explanations. You know, back then it was Cricket, now it's, well, it was drugs, it was this, it was that. And so I guess this makes sense, but sports are always quick to try and deflect blaming the sport itself for the condition.
Right. I mean, we talked about how Creighton was accused of cheating. And then 10 years after he died, everyone pretty much made up their mind that he had to have been cheating. And most history books say that he was cheating. I disagree. It's really weird that people like members of the Rules Committee and members of the Atlantics, who were the Excelsior's arch rivals, said when they saw Creighton, I mean, at length, they considered the question of whether his pitching was legal and decided it was. And then the same people 10, 12 years later are saying, oh, well, I saw him pitch in 1860 and it was clearly illegal. I mean, that's one of the weird things I had to try to explain in the book. And they don't even acknowledge changing their minds. And the reason is kind of crazy. The reason is that people couldn't do what Creighton did. Very few people could. There were a couple of pitchers that imitated him and were like 80% of Creighton. A lot of pitchers couldn't throw the curveball the way he did it. And so they cheated. They snuck a little wrist snap in there. And when some people who didn't understand what Creighton was doing saw people later cheating, they just figured Creighton must have been doing it, but he wasn't as obvious, which is kind of logical. I was thinking about how, you know, when a guy comes out of nowhere, remember Brady Anderson hitting, like, what was it, 54 home runs or something, or 51?
50 home runs, yeah.
People whisper, well, he must have been on steroids. There's no evidence for that, I don't think. But it's just that it was so anomalous. And let's say we have a modern Creighton coming along and he's throwing 185. The first thing people are going to say is, what is he on, right?
Yeah. So I think we want to move on next to the legacy piece of it. But Andrew, I think it looks like you had something, and I had one more question before we moved on to that. So go ahead.
I was just going to say, it would be like if in football, if a guy just started hitting 90-yard field goals, you'd be like, I can't figure out how he's cheating, but, like, nobody else can come close to this, so I'm going to jump to the conclusion that it's cheating and work backwards, and then...
Yeah, and that's kind of what happened.
So, let's just maybe digress just for a brief minute here, because Creighton is obviously the star of the book. He's the, you know, the guy who's on the cover. He's, you know, he's the person who this book is written about. But I have to say that I think perhaps my favorite part of the whole book was the story of Joe Leggett. So maybe just give us a quick minute or two on who Joe Leggett was and why you should be interested, because there's a lot of reasons.
There's nothing better than like a scoundrel, but also, you know, one who, weirdly enough, everybody liked.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking about Hal Chase, who was involved in all the gambling scandals around the Black Sox. Everyone loved him, too.
Mm-hmm.
But he was might have been a psychopath. He definitely had a gambling problem. But he was a sort of a hero. He was a great catcher. He was a kind of a scout and a coach. He was a little bit older than everybody else on the Excelsiors. I feel like baseball historians have overlooked the fact that he was the mentor and, in fact, discoverer of Creighton, Brainerd, and Candy Cummings, the alleged inventor of the curveball.
Mm-hmm. We'll get to that in a sec.
People who were the greatest pitchers of long periods of time in the middle 19th century had the same catcher, and it's not a coincidence. Okay, so he's a brilliant baseball guy. He was famous for not caring about his physical health and going right behind the batter with no gloves and trying to catch foul tips. You know, his body was all busted up in 1860. But so a guy who's a superhero, he's the all-American boy. Everyone loves him. Great teammate. People in baseball love him. Well, we were talking about amateurism. He didn't have a lot of money, and the Excelsiors took care of him with cushy jobs, mostly in government agencies, sometimes in other things that they were well-connected with, like charities. And he constantly embezzled and stole money from them and got fired. Or they would hush it up if they could. And when he retired, they kept getting him jobs. And he lost his job in the Brooklyn Fire Department for, I don't know if you can think of anything lower than this, but he embezzled a bunch of money from an effort from the Widows and Orphans Fund. And in the Civil War, of course, he served, and they made him quartermaster. Why not? He's a guy that's dishonest. Let's put him in charge of provisions for troops. And I actually dug up accusations by the men that he was selling the provisions and replacing them with cheaper stuff and pocketing the difference. And his commanding officer said he was the most wonderful fellow in the world, he said.
Commanding officer maybe didn't know too many people.
I think this guy had some kind of charm, or he mesmerized people. So then the fire department covers up the embezzlement, but then it leaks out. And well, of course, his resume is terrible at this point. This is like the third place he's been caught stealing. And it's that you realize at a certain point, I mean, before I proved that he had a gambling problem, I suspected it. Because his thefts were so stupid. You know, they're like desperate thefts. Well, you know, if you're a smart embezzler, you're raking a little bit off the top and you're doing it in a way that no one ever finds out. You're not like suddenly stealing 25 grand.
And I think you made the point that it had to be gambling, because if it was alcohol or women, he wouldn't have needed as much money as he ended up stealing. So
it has all the hallmarks of you owe some bad people money. And of course, what else happens to athletes who owe bad people money, right? So that's part of the book. But this is what we've known until I did this research, that after the fire department thing, well, of course he gets hired by the police department. The police department used to issue liquor licenses, and he was collecting the money in cash. What could go wrong? So he stole a bunch of it. And this, he got married late, so he had a wife and young children. And in Christmas of 1877, the scandal breaks about the missing liquor money and the license money, and he changes his name and goes to the West. And it's never heard from again. And I probably have spent parts of 30 years trying to track him down, and it's almost mission impossible. How do you find a guy who is intentionally hiding and not using his real name? And I tried everything you could think of. Maybe he got involved in baseball somewhere. There was one little clue, which is his family has a Bible that has a date and place of death.
Mm-hmm.
And his family suspected that he died in jail near Galveston, Texas in 1894. That turned out not to be true, but the date of death was right. You know, And then, you know, if you know anything about American history, you know why I wasn't going to be able to go through records from Galveston, Texas in the 1890s.
Flooding. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. There was the world's worst hurricane and there's nothing. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no gravestones. There's no records. There's no nothing. So I was looking for things like, I mean, ridiculous hunches. Like, did he use his mother's maiden name? You know, sometimes people do use, you know, Creighton, maybe. Yeah. I tried obituaries of people at his age. But anyway, one night, what I did discover was that his wife applied for a widow's pension from the War Department in 1899. And that would involve proving that her husband served and was dead. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, how did she... you could tell from the digitized records that she did this and she got the pension, but how did she prove he was dead? This is driving me crazy. And well, I don't want to ruin the whole mystery, but I found out everything that happened to him, an incredibly lucky break. And it's like, he goes to the Wild West. He goes to Cheyenne, Wyoming in 1878. You know what that was like?
lots of space for a man who wants to get lost.
That bastard in 20 saloons, 2,500 people. Yeah, I mean, a crazy, crazy place where gambling is what it's all about. And he got into more trouble, but it's all told in the book.
Yeah, that was a fascinating sort of detour to hear about all that and your efforts in trying to trying to chase down that that story. And, you know, certainly glad his wife was able to get his Civil War pension and that his service to the country in the Civil War of stealing provisions and profiting was not in vain. So
it takes a real guy to steal from the military, the fire department, the police department, and the civil service. That's another kind of cycle, I think, for a baseball player.
Quadruple crown. That's a good way of thinking about it. Yeah. I mean, he was an equal opportunity crook, and it's just weird how much people like this guy and kept giving him second chances.
That's how guys like that get away with it.
I guess so. I mean, Danny McLean gets a lot of second chances.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. There were two other things I wanted to touch on. And the first is just sort of the fact that he probably deserves more of a claim to being the inventor of the curveball than Candy Cummings. And that's how, you know, even people who really know baseball, that's how you know Candy Cummings. The guy, he pitched, I think, in the NA for a few years, and then I think he was on the National League for like one season, but he is known as the inventor of the curveball. And
yeah, his first club was actually the Excelsiors.
Okay.
So Leggett finds him when he's 14. Mm-hmm. I think Leggett taught all three of those guys the curveball. I think Leggett and Creighton came up with it together, mm-hmm. and Leggett taught the next two guys.
And it sounds like the biggest thing, or maybe the biggest thing, again, maybe sort of to the point you were making about Leggett in a much more benign way, but part of the reason why Candy Cummings gets the credit is, first of all, he was alive to tell his story, which is always, you know, good. But also from what you have in the book, it seems like Cummings was a nice, affable guy who people liked. And so they were willing to give him the credit for something that maybe he hadn't actually been the first to do.
And he it's true. And, you know, he was fun to have a beer with. He had a good story. The story changed suspiciously, but you ever hear the story about throwing clamshells at the beach? That was his story.
Yeah. I remember that going way back to the Ken Burns baseball documentary 30 years ago. And then when you reiterated in the book and I'm not a science person. So you said that the tale was, I forget the exact phrasing you used, but you basically said, this is a crazy story on its face. And I actually didn't know it was a crazy story on its face, but I guess it's kind of a dumb analogy to make between clamshells and baseballs.
Right. Clamshells spin for reasons that have nothing to do with what is the name of the, I'm spacing out now, but the physical principle that makes a curveball.
Okay. Like the torque. Yeah.
Yeah, it's clamshells are obviously flat, and they spin like a frisbee. I mean, the story makes no sense.
Okay, maybe I did get it, and I was thinking too hard about it.
But it's very compelling because details like that, Johnny Appleseed planting trees and George Washington chopping down cherry trees. That stuff really sells people on a story.
Yeah, and baseball's full of those. I forget whether it was Walter Johnson or somebody who they used to say that, you know, he honed his arm throwing rocks at squirrels to feed his family during, you know, bad economic times. That's a very baseball thing, is sort of the story of the pitcher, especially, who uses his skills for survival or something else before he, you know, becomes a major league pitcher.
What you find when you go through history so often is a powerful narrative takes over and drives everything out. But you go before the narrative gets set, and you find interesting little things, like someone saying in the 1880s that Candy Cummings learned the curveball from Creighton. Wow. Yeah. Right across that. And you know what is the most suspicious thing about Candy Cummings' story? So Joe Leggett, who's like was 40, finds Cummings on a sandlot as a kid, sits down at the kitchen table with his parents and says, "Will you give me permission to have him play on an adult team? Mm-hmm. He's that good." And then he mentors him and turns him into the greatest pitcher in the country for a couple of years. And his name is not mentioned in Cummings' version of the story.
Mm-hmm. Good point. Good point.
It doesn't add to his credibility. Anyway, Creighton, if he did do it, he did it 10 years before any of the other candidates. And I think when you go looking for the beginning of something, the big pitfall is, you know, you're almost never going to find the first. Whoever gets credited with being the first is usually the 31st.
I kind of wanted to close with a quote from the very end of the book. And this is a little cliched, and I think you probably know what's coming, but it would be malpractice on our parts not to bring it up. And this is a guy who was maybe one of the first to propose the Hall of Fame. And he talks about how the Hall of Fame would consist of Doubleday, who we're obviously not off to a good start there, but then would be an open field for the George and Harry Wrights, A.G. Spaulding, Dan McBride, who I believe is actually Dick McBride, right, Creighton, Leggett, and then down the line through, and all these guys are no question Hall of Famers: Anson, Brewers, Keeler, Wagner, Hornsby, Lajoie, Cobb, Mathewson, Walsh, to Babe Ruth. At some point, Creighton was considered, this is a guy you absolutely would have in the Hall of Fame. It wasn't even a question. It was just, of course you're going to have him. You know, it's like, of course you're going to have Lincoln on Mount Rushmore. Who comes next? Maybe is a question, but you know, that guy is going to be there. What happened? Why, with the Hall of Fame rapidly approaching, 100 years from now, and you know, when you and I and others head to the Fred Convention in a few weeks in Cooperstown, why aren't we going to walk by Creighton's bust?
Yeah, I mean, that's actually probably one of the biggest reasons he's forgotten, that he's not there. And I would turn it around and say there's a lot of people who are remembered because they were put in, mm-hmm, who might not be if they weren't. I mean, maybe no one would have heard of Roger Bresnahan if he wasn't in.
Yeah.
So, and the other factor is that ultimately the decision about which of the sort of first generation pioneers, when they're honoring their baseball's early days, that decision was made by a commissioner and two league presidents. It wasn't made by historians or even journalists. And I don't think they cared that much about getting it right. It was just something they wanted to get out of the way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a quirky institution. I'm not going to criticize it because they do their thing. But they don't have any real consistent criteria. Some, you know, people will say, how can you put someone in the Hall of Fame who didn't play professional baseball? Of course, there are people who they kind of shoehorned in who didn't, they were involved in professional baseball, but they, you know, George Wright is in there because he was the greatest shortstop of the 19th century. They put him in originally as an executive because he happened to be president of the Red Sox later. I mean, they're willing to bend their own criteria, and they're willing to suddenly, they could tomorrow have a committee decide whether they really picked the right early guys from the amateur era. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's such a bright line between amateur baseball and pro baseball as some people think. This is a question we like to argue about. But take the Atlantics, who were the Excelsior's big enemies. They were a team that won every year for almost 10 years. Greatest amateur dynasty. When those guys were in their mid-30s to early 40s, many of them were stars in the National League and the American Association. I mean, that's kind of weird. Yeah. I think that amateur baseball at the top level was a lot more competitive than people give it credit for. And it's not one or two guys. It's lots of great players from the amateur or stayed great. And if professional baseball had represented such a competitive elite, you know, they wouldn't be winning batting titles when they're 40.
That's a good point. Well, this is a great story. A bunch of great stories, you know, the Brooklyn story, the sort of the early baseball story, which I know is probably more the subject of your previous book than this one, but there's a lot of that in this, a lot of that material in here too. Leggett and you know, and obviously Creighton. So we want to thank you again for joining us, Tom. The book is called Death in the Strike Zone, The Mystery of America's First Baseball Hero. And our guest has been the author, Thomas W. Gilbert. Thanks again for joining us.
Thanks. And if I could say one more thing, I think we mentioned that he has the first baseball card.
You did. Posthumously, correct?
I think last I heard there's two of them. If anyone finds anyone out there, you know, take good care of it. I don't know what it would be worth, but I think we're talking seven figures.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, maybe that's another way to get him into the Hall of Fame if he has a really valuable baseball card.
Well, maybe my book and shows like yours will do it.
Yeah, no, that'd be great. And the Veterans Committee needs to be rethunk, because they're basically having everybody from pre-1980 is one committee, and then that committee last time their big inductee was Dick Allen, who played until like 1982. So they need to redo the lenses that they're looking for with these committees, but that's a story for another day. So Tom, I want to thank you again so much for joining us. We appreciate it. As I've said, I've seen and heard your presentations before. Always enjoys them. So thanks for spending some time with us tonight.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And Andrew and I will be back soon to, just the two of us again to talk about another topic in sports history. And we want to thank you all, as always, for joining us. Until then, I'm Dan Newman.
I'm Andrew Newman. Goodbye, old sports.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com. Hey there, sports history fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I hope that you enjoyed this recent episode presented by the Sports History Network and were able to learn some good old-fashioned sports history knowledge nuggets. I started the Sports History Network back in 2020 with the mission to help podcasters find a community of like-minded sports history nerds, as well as helping aspiring podcasters to start their own shows. We have a little bit over 30 shows on the network right now covering all sorts of sports history, but as far as I'm concerned, we're just at the toothpick in the ocean moment, you know, that can't even figure it out because there's so much more coming. We wanted to create the ultimate headquarters for sports yesteryear, starting with Podcast Network and our website, but we're going to continue to move into other mediums as well. And here's the cool part, because we want you to be part of our team. So if you're interested in starting your own podcast, or maybe being a guest on one of our shows, or who knows, maybe even writing an article for us over on the website. Seriously, all you got to do is reach out to us on the contact page over at sportshistorynetwork.com. You can be as technologically savvy as a Neanderthal tapping on a stone trying to figure out this whole hieroglyphics thing back in the day. Again, it doesn't matter, because even if you don't understand the whole podcast space, we have a production team that can pretty much help you out with doing everything. All you gotta do, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com, head to the contact page, fill it out. That message goes right to me, and I'll reach out to you as soon as I can. But for now, dude, I'm through if you're through.